Hello, friends, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM channel 130. Of course, our radio show is also a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org or directly to wherever you listen to your podcast. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and this Thanksgiving week here in the U.S., we're celebrating all things American, but we're happy to take a brief interlude and jump across the pond to check in with Edward Penton, who is a senior contributor for the National Catholic Register and an EWTN News Vatican analyst. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashley. Good to be with you.
Edward, we have both written articles about a man named Jimmy Lai, who, for our listeners, if they're not familiar, is a former newspaper publisher and media mogul who has been in jail unjustly for 4 years now in a maximum security prison in China in solitary confinement, where he has been detained on bogus charges of violating national security. And in fact, really, he's become the sort of global face of conscience rights, the conscience rights movement, in that he refused to kowtow to the Chinese Communist Party and allow his newspaper to become just a propaganda rag. And he's an incredibly inspiring man in that he is quite wealthy. He could have hopped on a plane and left the country and been, you know, living as an expat somewhere. And instead, he chose to stay back and stand shoulder to shoulder with other members of the resistance movement of Hong Kong. I think, Edward, the thing that's really burning the brains of so many people who are following this case, it's back in the news because he's on trial now and we're hearing from him for the first time in years, is, you know, he's attracted a real following. And as you note in the article that you've written, there's countless leaders from other countries who've spoken out. You have even entities like Amnesty International that are decrying his unjust detention and his real kind of kangaroo trial. But we're not really hearing anything from the Vatican. And Lai is a convert to Catholicism, and really his deep Catholic faith is what, you know, he and others attribute to the strength that he gets to endure. And yet we're not really hearing anything from the Vatican or the Pope. What's your take on that, Edward?
Yes, it is rather peculiar. And it's really all to do with the sort of Ostpolitik stance the Vatican is taking in lots of areas, actually, not just with China, but also to some extent with Russia and Ukraine. And it's really because they're trying to take this approach, which actually failed during the Cold War, which was to try to have a sort of conciliatory approach to communism, and to try to just deal with them with dialogue in the hope that they'll come round and support the Vatican's way of of thinking. Excuse me, but it is rather unfortunate because I think, as I say, the strategy failed. And I think the Vatican, though, especially with the current leadership, especially with Cardinal Parolin as Secretary of State, they're very much champions of this approach, and they think it works. And the interesting thing is that Cardinal Parolin gave a speech, as did Cardinal Stephen Chow, the Bishop of Hong Kong. They spoke at the same conference in Rome last week, basically outlining why they take this approach, which they feel is a way to better engage the Chinese, because they've been trying to pursue this policy of sinicization. It's an ancient policy of trying to enculturate everything into Chinese culture. But since 2014, it's stepped up a gear with President Xi Jinping. And so their view is that to try to ruffle their feathers, as it were, but to try to go along with Beijing in the hope that they will get some concessions from Beijing by doing so. They think they have done that by getting this provisional agreement, which they signed with Beijing in 2018, the Vatican did, in order on the appointment of bishops. But that provisional agreement, it remains secret. We don't know what it contains, obviously. And it's the fruits have been mixed, to say the least. So again, there's this great question mark about whether this approach is working. And then you have someone like Jimmy Lai, of course, who's being left in jail without any moral voice, the strong moral voice of the Vatican coming to his aid, even as you say, he's a Catholic convert.
Edward, what did Cardinal Chow, what has he said about this case? He's the cardinal for Hong Kong, and this falls under his leadership. What has he had to say on the fate of Jimmy Lai?
Yes, well, he's not. I did get in touch with him, or at least the diocese, for the article I wrote about Jimmy Lai last week. He said that he didn't think, because the judicial proceedings are going on, it was right for him to speak about it. And he said he just prayed that Jimmy Lai could be at peace. That was all he said. Now, that hasn't stopped other, leading figures in the politics or human rights to speak out. So it doesn't quite make sense why he would say that. But of course, it is the whole underlying reason is, as I said, this whole general approach. But I don't think he's done either anything really behind the scenes to help Jimmy Lai and secure his release either. It's what I've heard from people close to him, that the diocese hasn't really come in to help him, even just to offer words of support in private, it seems. So that's another mystery too. But yes, it's there's lots of sort of holes in this approach, I think a lot of people feel.
The reason people are curious about some of the silence from the Vatican is, as we know, Pope Francis is not one to be silent about a lot of the crises that are going on in the world. He's been quite outspoken about what's going on in the Middle East. And you point out in your article that many people who know Jimmy Lai must know that he must, the silence must make it all the harder, in that he's kind of living this living martyrdom for his beliefs, and which is, being met with silence from above. And this, I was very interested to read about this concept of sinicization. And you quote Benedict Rogers, the co-founder of Hong Kong Watch, who says, it sounds like he's saying this is not going to work. He says Xi Jinping does not want the Catholic Church in China and Hong Kong to adapt to Chinese culture. He wants the church to kowtow to the Marxist, Leninist, Chinese Communist Party regime. And if the church chooses to do that, it ceases to be the church and becomes an extension of Beijing's United Front. That is the choice. Do you have a sense of which direction it's going? I guess you've said you don't think sinicization is working. What's actually happening?
Yes, well, they're certainly trying their best to enforce it. I think what Benedict Rogers said is widely, a lot of people agree with that, because I think what's seen is the Vatican being rather naive about this approach. At least that's what it seems like. Whether they're actually aware of it and they're still going ahead with this conciliatory approach, we don't know. But it does seem as though they must be aware of this. But as Cardinal Chow said in his speech, he said, and I wrote this in the piece, that he thinks that China has moved on from seeing the Catholic Church as an enemy designed to impose Western control and Western culture on Chinese culture. That's how it's been seen in the past. Now he's thinking, well, if that's not the case, if they're moving on from that, well, then maybe we can talk, you see. So they still think, despite the sinicization and it's, trying to make the whole state social, everything socialist, including the church, he thinks that they can sort of work around that by basically distancing the church from the West. And so if the church isn't seen as some Western alien culture imposing itself on Chinese culture, then perhaps there's a way forward. But yes, that's obviously what a lot of people like Benedict Rogers don't agree with.
Well, it certainly seems like Jimmy Lai, who's not Western, is exposing a real fault line in the
Right.
concept of sinicization, in the sense that he is emblematic of the notion of conscience rights, that we are individuals and that our rights come from a higher power than the state. They come from God. And there are moments when we're called to stand apart from the state. And he's just been such an inspiration in the sense that he's been willing to do that at great cost. And it's very clear, the beautiful drawings that we were able to see from prison, that his faith is really what's driving him here. So
What I think is also interesting, though, actually, is that well, if you look at where the Vatican has spoken out, it hasn't really, under this pontificate, it's hard to see where the Vatican has really come to the defense of somebody like Jimmy Lai, who's fighting for freedom and human rights in the way that he is against a communist regime. In fact, quite the opposite has happened. You've had the Pope and the Vatican weighing in say, Venezuela, really quite in a positive way, defense or at least in a sort of sympathetic way, to Nicolas Maduro, the president, who's obviously a communist. And then you've got Cuba as well. So you've got these different countries where the Vatican seems quite happy to speak out. When it seems to be someone like Jimmy Lai who's fighting for freedom against a communist regime, they go rather quiet. So again, it's for this approach, but it does seem to be rather selective.
Well, we have a new administration coming in, and it's worth noting that Donald Trump, in a recent radio interview, said that he could, quote, 100% get Jimmy Lai out. And he said, kind of in classic Trump fashion, it would be easy. And I'm not sure about that, but, I will be. What do you think could happen? I mean, for China's really backed itself against a wall because it would be a huge embarrassment to release him or to admit, that his detention was wrong. And yet, this change in administration could really shake things up. I mean, is there any cause for real hope that a new administration could somehow orchestrate his release?
Well, there is some hope. I spoke to the, for the article with Bill McGurn, who's the commentator on the Wall Street Journal, and he was saying that yes, he thinks there is a lot of hope, partly because of the hawkish approach to Beijing by the Trump administration. There's also sanctions already placed on key Hong Kong officials, and then of course, if tariffs are imposed on China, that might be another stick to help get him out. But he did think that he'll have to be jailed first, and then spend perhaps a bit of time in jail before they actually release him, if that's possible. But he was, as I say, Bill McGurn was hopeful about it. I think others are too, and he also believes that the international pressure on the Hong Kong government and Beijing can only grow at this point to get him out. So yeah, and then if he does get out, he thinks he'll go probably come to live in Britain, which is also another bonus for Beijing, because once he's out of the country, they'll no longer have to worry about him. So he'll be quiet outside the country. So that's why there's quite a lot of hope behind this.
One thing I've wondered about this case, and you as a journalist, China is notoriously secret. There's lots of propaganda. How do you even tease out what's true and the facts? I read things here and there that he's been denied Holy Communion, that sometimes Cardinal Zen is able to meet with him. How do you as a journalist sort through all that and figure out what are the real facts in this case?
Yes, it isn't easy, but I think one of the things that you can be pretty sure of is that what you hear from Beijing or from the Hong Kong government, a lot of it is sadly propaganda, and what you do get is a frankness from the other side. So you do get a pretty good idea of what's true and what's not. What is also interesting, though, is when you have a lot of pushback from various people who possibly are paid up agents of the CCP, who knows, but there's a lot of bots out there who will come to try to push their propaganda view in response to something which is clearly true in this case or in other cases, which is quite interesting to see how that sort of operation sort of is launched. Once the truth gets out into the public domain, they quickly hit back. So that's, yeah, it is a bit of a minefield, but I think it's pretty clear which side is telling the truth, and which aspects of this case are true and which are not.
Well, one aspect that I've read about is that his health is failing. And is that true? And what do you know about that?
Well, I think his health is failing. I was in touch with Mark Simon, who's an old work colleague and friend of Jimmy Lai, and he did play it down a bit. He said, well, he's showing the signs of age, but he's not at death's door or anything like that. He is a diabetic, and he's 77 next month, and so he's getting on, and he is looking frailer, but he didn't think it was a terrible health situation at this point.
Well, certainly we are all should be praying for him and be grateful for him this week as we're celebrating Thanksgiving. Grateful for men with courage like him, who can continue to stand up to totalitarian regimes. And thank you, Edward, for coming on the show. Thank you for your journalistic efforts to shed light on this important case. And to learn more about Edward Petten, you can catch all of his writings at the National Catholic Register by visiting ncregister.com. And presumably you're on social media. Where can we follow you on social media?
Sure, Ashley, I'm on Twitter with my handle, Edward Penton.
Great. Well, thank you for joining me today, Edward, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ashley. Good to be with you.
Next, I'm glad to welcome back my TCA colleague, Betsy Fentress, who is joining me this Thanksgiving week to touch on the things that matter most: our family, our faith, our friends, our freedom, what wonderful things we have to be grateful for. And I'm so grateful that you're here to discuss this with me, Betsy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me again, Ashley. Great to be here.
So, Betsy, you're a hospitality guru, and I thought we'd briefly touch on that because so many people are opening their homes and practicing hospitality this week. And, I think when we hear the word hospitality in our modern times, we think of, I don't know, the hospitality industry and five star and fancy soaps and but that's not really what it's about. What does hospitality mean to you, especially this week, this Thanksgiving week?
I think first and foremost, it makes people feel loved. It makes people feel that they can let down and be who they are. It's not really about the stuff or the fanciness. It's about everybody sitting around a table and feeling that they have something to say and that it's valued. And overall, it's just this, I mean, it's Eucharistic, right? I mean, we're a Catholic organization. So everything really points back to Christ's love for us and how we mirror that with other people. And as you know, and as you know, it's kind of been, I've done these three cookbooks. It's, I think the funnest way to do that is around a table.
Yeah, and you've written and talked about the table, the earthly table as a reflection of the divine table. Can you remind our listeners about that connection and how sharing a meal gives us a sort of divine experience?
Well, I think that, being fed is at the heart of the Mass, and the Eucharist is the source and summit of our lives. And there's a great book called The Hungry Soul by Leon Cass, and he writes a lot about our basic needs first being met before we can feed our soul. And so I think that that's what's so wonderful around our table. And if you look at so many of the charitable organizations around the world, the first thing that they do is feed people. They meet their basic needs. And Mother Teresa was all about that. And I think that we don't have our basic needs not met like so many people. But Mother Teresa also said when she came to the United States, the spiritual loneliness here and the spiritual poverty was way worse than the poverty that she experienced in India, because it was a deep, more deeply rooted.
Yeah, and I know we've discussed that when we've talked about this before, this strange phenomenon that we have such an abundance of food and such an emphasis on meals and eating in our culture, and yet this loneliness crisis. And so, my hope is that this Thursday is a time that people are able to reconnect with friends and family. And I, for us women who are often the ones who wind up hosting, it can be a very frazzling time. And what practical thoughts or tips do you have on how to make Thanksgiving an experience for women that isn't totally overwhelming and totally frazzling and has us be more Mary than Martha, if that's possible?
I say share your kitchen. Don't be one of these people that everything has to look perfect. Let people come in and let it get a little messy. Whether it's, I used to have to make jello when I was little. Nobody does that anymore, but that was always my job. And I always love to set the table the day before. It just, I go in there and no matter how much of a wreck the rest of my house is, I go in and I look at the table and it calms me down. And I would also say cook what you love and not what you think other people will want to have at your house so that you look fancy or special or innovative. There are so many websites that I think are phenomenal for this. I usually go to WilliamSonoma.com. They always have good recipes. And, just make it simple. If somebody says, "Can I bring something?" Say yes. Say yes 10 times over for flowers. I am not a particularly accomplished flower arranger. So, I always say yes, or people say, "What can I bring?" And it's amazing how many women have that talent, and men too. And I love it when people offer to either order the flowers and have them delivered to my house or bring them.
And I think I don't know if you were a kid when you were making the jello, but I hadn't thought of that. But putting your kids to work, I mean, when I was growing up, I was one of five, and each of us had something that we were responsible for making. And I always made the cranberry sauce, and I make a really good cranberry sauce now because I've been making it for decades. But it's something that I've started to teach my daughter to make. And she's now at the point where she can make it herself. And so, us moms, I suppose we can put our little minions to work.
Well, and one year my grandkids wanted to make the place cards. And I do kind of like a nice like Crane and Company place card with this cute little engraved turkey. Of course, they're all different sizes, the handwriting. And I treasure those. Don't be fussy. Just let everybody have a little bit of their handprint on the day.
Well, that's great advice, Betsy, and just so much to be grateful for, all the helping hands. And so, with what time we have left, I wanted to pivot to another topic, which is the theme of Thanksgiving, which is thankfulness. And I love the origins of Thanksgiving, President Lincoln's declaration on establishing it in a time when there was just real division in the country after the Civil War. And here we are, Thanksgiving. It falls every year after, well, every 4 years after an election year, every 2 years. And so it can be a difficult time.
Exactly.
And we've had another kind of contentious election, and people with a lot of different ideas are going to be gathering at the table. How can we as hosts help to steer conversation towards things that are fruitful and away from the things that divide us?
Well, not to be trite, but I do think laughter is the best medicine. And one of the tricks I keep up my sleeve, if I think things might be going south, is remember a story about someone at your table and ask them to recount it. I just did this the other night. I had people over. Another great way to get ready for Thanksgiving is to entertain the weekend before. So you it kind of forces you to get your house ready. But people love to share fun stories about themselves. And I do this a lot. And I knew a story because somebody else had told me about one of our guests. And I said, tell us that story because I had not heard it directly from her. And people, it just sort of can break any kind of tension and call attention to one person and their personal life and not necessarily in their over. A new overarching view of, the state of the world right now, which obviously people don't agree on right now.
Right. Well, and I know we share a common friend who really does a great job of what she calls having the table have one conversation.
Right.
And we've seen this friend of ours ask people ahead of time to think about, something that they're kind of an expert on, or that they have something interesting, a point of view to speak briefly about. And preparing for conversation ahead of time. The same person also taught me something that we try to exercise with our children, which is to have a few things we're going to talk about when we sit down for family dinner with our kids. Okay, this son did XYZ, talk to us
Right.
about that. They had a field trip. What did you do at the field trip? And, a conversation is both on the one hand natural, and on the other hand, I think has to be guided a little bit. And so, that's one thing that I've seen work very well and can help kind of keep the conversation away from politics and towards things that bring people out and make them shine.
Well, don't you have a gratitude list that when you're feeling stressed or you're feeling maybe ungrateful that you go to? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I wrote an article, it was 2019, so 5 years ago, Thanksgiving. It was after the last, or must have been 4 years ago, the last election. And it basically was about a lot of the social science that has found that actively exercising gratitude, like a muscle that you exercise at the gym, is one of the best antidotes to anxiety, to depression. And I was very much influenced by a writer and thinker, Yuval Levin, who has written a book about the topic of gratitude and gave a speech that I had recently attended about gratitude as a virtue, and really a foundational conservative principle that, you know, what makes us want to protect and defend what we value in this world, our country, our faith, our family, is that these are things that we're grateful for. And there's been all this social science that has found that just thinking grateful thoughts can dramatically help with everything from anxiety to sleep. And so what I have found myself doing is, if I am being a little bit selfish or bratty or woe is me, I stop and I try to count to 10 of 10 things that I'm grateful for. And often I start
Wonderful.
with really basic stuff. I mean, like, if I'm looking at a sink full of dirty dishes, I'm like, I'm grateful for running water. You know, if I have screaming kids running around the house, I'm grateful for my children. And that has actually been a mindset that has changed my life for the better. And so on that note, I thought I would close us out with this quote that I had in the article that I rediscovered when I reread it. And I just love it. It's a quote from Mr. Rogers. And he said that, "I believe that appreciation is a holy thing, that when we look for what's best in the person we happen to be with at the moment, we're doing what God does. So in appreciating our neighbor, we're participating in something truly sacred." And I think that just perfectly ties together the themes we've discussed today, Betsy, about hospitality as a way of treating those at our table as sacred, as children of God, and as a way of appreciating them, showing our appreciation for them, and bringing out gratitude, which is truly a wonderful virtue that we'll all be exercising this Thanksgiving. So thank you, Betsy. So great talking with you.
Thanks, Ashley. And I love that quote, and it's a great way for us to end. And happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving. All right, thank you.
Patrick Sneed, welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. November is National Adoption Month, and we're also getting ready to celebrate Thanksgiving. Elizabeth Kirk is with us today. She is the co-director of the Center for Law and the Human Person at Columbus School of Law at the Catholic University of America, where she is also an assistant professor. Elizabeth's work engages adoption and public policy, family law, Catholic moral and intellectual tradition. Elizabeth's also an adoptive mom, so it affects her professional life and her personal life. She and I have shared a lot of our journey together, living in the same city when we were both pursuing adoption, and our kids grew up for probably about 10 years together, I think, Elizabeth. Anyway, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Lee.
Why don't we just start with you telling us a little bit about your family?
Sure. Well, there's a lot I could say here, but my husband and I, right, but with respect to adoption in particular, my husband and I discerned a call to adoption primarily in the context of our experience with infertility and miscarriage. But our journey to adoption actually had its roots in my own story, which is that my mom had me when she was in college in what, you know, we call a crisis pregnancy, and she chose life for me. And when I was about three, she married the man who would adopt me and become my father. And so his example of what the gift of fatherhood, the gift of parenthood looked like, sort of, if you will, tilled the soil for my husband and I, for Bill and I, to think about adoption as we were trying to discern how God was calling our marriage to be fruitful. So we have four children, all through adoption. The first three we adopted at birth and, you know, brought them home from the hospital. And each of their circumstances was a bit different, but that's, you know, the sort of general story. And then our last little guy, we met through an organization. We were providing respite care to foster families. 20s, and he was a foster child. We ended up becoming his foster parents and then adopting him when he was about two. So in our personal journeys, we've experienced a lot of the different aspects of adoption, you know, what might be called step-parent adoption, domestic infant adoption, foster adoption.
Right.
And as you say, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's like even almost 20 years later, I got the chills just hearing the story about your mom and dad. It's just so beautiful. And that really influenced you professionally too, right? You were interested in sort of adoption policy before you became a mother through adoption. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I always, from the time I was in college and law school, felt drawn to using my professional skills in service to the human person generally, but specifically in the context of the life issues. And so I sort of very quickly became interested in adoption and foster care. And it just so happens that it's also a kind of perfect, you know, compliment to my personal life as well. So
we won't get too into the weeds because you are a legal scholar and not all of us are, but you had a recent Law Review article that I thought made a really important point that I think a lot of people who want to be supportive of adoption, and especially those who are devoted to the pro-life cause and our political landscape, we're here in a post-Dobbs world, all these different things. We're all wondering, you know, what's adoption's place here? What are we going to do here? And you point out in this article that even though most people's initial reaction to hearing about an adoptive story, the idea of adoption, someone else choosing adoption for their crisis pregnancy baby, all positive feelings, yet many people don't adopt. Many women don't place their child for adoption. So what can we do, you know, as Catholics, as a society? What does policy and law have to do with that? Again, without getting too deep into the legal weeds.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic. You're right. It's sort of been described as the adoption paradox, you know, that people have this positive view of adoption, but it's so rarely chosen. Either as a response to a crisis pregnancy, we know that a ratio of 50-1, women who are, for whatever reason, not able to parent choose abortion over adoption. So for every one infant placed for adoption, 50 are aborted.
Yeah.
And then we also know that families who are experiencing infertility or, you know, trying to build their families also don't consider adoption, as opposed to something like IVF or, you know, something else. And so it's definitely a disfavored choice. And our article, which I won't get into the weeds on, but one of the goals of the article was to try to understand better that dynamic. A lot of people generally, but also especially on the pro-choice side, say that because of that, because women don't choose adoption, that we shouldn't try to encourage them to do it, that it would be sort of like a forced constrained choice. Sure. And we were trying to understand that dynamic a bit better. And we conclude, I'm a co-author on this article, and we conclude that most women who make adoption placements today, so under, you know, adoption is very different today than it was, say, 40, 50 years ago, where it took place in an atmosphere of shame and, you know, that sort of thing. And so we conclude that most women who choose it today experience their choice positively. But that there's a lot of misinformation, right?
Yeah,
that women,
absolutely.
For example, they think like, oh, if I place my baby for adoption, that means it's going to go in the foster care system.
Right.
Or they don't know that they have agency, that they get to pick the adoptive family and they can have contact with the family and things like that. So there's just a lot of misinformation around adoption. So what can we do? One of the things that we recommend is that there's just more information provided to women who are considering abortion specifically, but anyone really who's in a decision-making mode about the option of adoption.
Right. And you talk a lot about, sometimes it's hard to distinguish what I've listened to you say in a talk or our personal conversations or essays you've written for journals, Humanum, Alitea. But you talk a lot about the soft stigma of adoption. That still, even though we're past the baby scoop era, past a lot of that shamefulness, past the secretive nature of like it within adoptive families, not telling your child they're adopted because, you know, it's a secret. It's something to be ashamed of or something. You know, it still persists,
right?
You know, and that, so can you talk about more like how to overcome that and what do we do?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we can do. I mean, you know, I'm in law, there's things we can do in policy. You know, one really great program in Louisiana is that their state health education requirement for public schools requires a module on adoption.
Wow.
And I think that's a really great way. Yeah, it's really great. And I there's a curriculum that's been developed called Option Hope that, again, seeks to inform and sort of change the culture on that, you know, pushing against that soft stigma so that women, who, you know, that, so that the population in general experiences adoption as something that's positive and not shameful. And also, again, to see it as something that's not a kind of forced, constrained choice, but rather as something that is empowering. And I think, you know, to the extent we can change the narrative that adoption, obviously it takes place in broken circumstances and we don't want to downplay that. But I think to the extent we can get away from the narrative that children who are placed for adoption are unwanted or abandoned, right? The language of giving up your child giving away your child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so helping, and I think birth mothers themselves, that is women who've chosen adoption, can be really beautiful witnesses for this, that it is a positive, empowering choice. Yeah,
absolutely.
I was just going to say that, you know, I think speaking truthfully in a way that helps inform the culture about the choice of adoption is important to do. That's one aspect. I think also on the sort of back end, coming alongside those who've chosen adoption, either birth mothers or foster parents or adoptive parents, stepping in to support them, because many children, you know, who especially experience time in the foster care system may have special challenges. And I think coming around to support them also helps to create more of a positive culture of life, but also a culture that supports adoption as a response to that.
I think, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that you highlighted it briefly in your family story, is one of the things you can really do is provide respite care for those families who are providing foster care, or even just have a child with significant emotional trauma or special needs. I think we've talked about this too before, like basic things, like don't skip the foster family on your meal train, you know, make sure that you're cooking casseroles for them too, just because you didn't see, you know, them pregnant at mass and whatever. Oh, and speaking of the church, do you know, this is sort of off the cuff, is there any adoption talk in most marriage preparation courses? Because that seems like it would go a long way to promoting the culture.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I, you know, even prior to that, I think helping couples to think through how they might experience childbearing generally, you know, I think my own experience, you know, I can only speak anecdotally really on this. I don't know what the curricula is used across the country, but I think that generally speaking, there's probably some education about, you know, natural family planning or, you know, communicating that the church disapproves of contraception and that sort of thing. But beyond that, right, what does it look like for couples who experience any kind of struggle or cross related to childbearing, whether it's, you know, you and I both know couples who've struggled with like uber fertility, right? And, you know, and in a beautiful way, accept their children, but also struggle with that. And, you know, and at the other end, couples who struggle with infertility. And I think both pre-marriage counseling or preparation, but also walking alongside couples through those years is really, really important. And in my own experience was really lacking.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, because I think just telling folks that if infertility happens, IVF's off the table, and then moving on to the next topic isn't quite the same thing as explaining like what that life can be. And even, I mean, I think you and I both experienced talking to people who had adopted maybe before we both adopted children. And then also, I think you and I both and our husbands really take our role as sort of adoption infertility mentors pretty seriously, and have talked to a lot of people. People send people to both of us to talk about it. And oftentimes a lot of them do end up pursuing adoption and are so glad about it. And I think that being a witness to it and, you know, or just handing them one of your kids. I mean, our kids are big now, so we can't really just pass them around, but, you know, showing them what, you know, be an example of a happy family. And the fact that, I mean, it's still a miracle to me that you and I have eight between us. I think about some of those years when we just were, you know, commiserating and just longing for babies. And here we are, you know, and I think that people need to see that happy endings come in different shapes, and adoption is a really beautiful way to do that. One last thing I want to talk about, and something you talk about a lot, and I think it's from JP2's letter to women, about the adoption is a true exchange of gifts. And in adoption parlance, we talk about the adoption triad. Can you explain to us the gifts that are exchanged between, say, the adoptive parents, the birth parents, and the adoptee?
Yeah, I think this is really, really beautiful. And Saint Pope John Paul, you know, had such a sensitivity to the human person, both in their struggles and also their capacities for, you know, beauty and gift. So this actually came from an address that he gave to adoptive families that was organized by the Missionaries of Charity. And adoption, Mother Teresa also spoke a lot about adoption and its, you know, beauty. So anyway, that's where it came from. And he said to adopt a child is a work of great love and a true exchange of gifts. And I think, first of all, I think what that means in the context of adoption is that adoption properly understood is something that's ordered toward the good of another, right? Mm-hmm. A gift is something that's, you know, not selfless, right? It's for the other. And so adoption properly understood from the birth mom's perspective or from the adoptive parent's perspective has to be ordered towards the good of the child. And I think that really distinguishes it from other practices we see today, like surrogacy or, you know, IVF, where it's sort of seeking after a product or providing this, you know, desired commodity. Rather, the child is in adoption is seen as gift. And the birth mother puts the good of her child, you know, above her own natural good, right? And the adoptive parents also have to receive the child in that same spirit of gift. So they can't view the birth mother as sort of a means to get a baby, right? Rather, they're all knit together by this ordering towards the good of the child.
Yeah, it is profoundly beautiful. And it's such a gift that he's given us, that sort of language to talk about it. And doesn't he also speak of adoption as a form of procreation somewhere? I feel like I've
And I think this is, absolutely. He does talk about that. I think that's in Familiaris Consortio, but he talks about how a child, basically it's really a word of hope and a word of consolation to those who are struggling to conceive, because he talks about the fact that marriages are called to be fruitful and that might look different in different marriages. So for a couple experiencing infertility and really feeling like their bodies are failing them or their marriage is failing, you know, that the two become one literally in a child. And when that doesn't happen, it's the occasion for a lot of pain, right? And so John Paul speaks really beautifully about how procreative love is first and foremost, this is a quote from him, a gift of self, right? And so there's a form of procreation that happens in something like adoption, where you're welcoming a child, that your home is sort of like a place of hospitality, right? That's ordered, your marriage is ordered towards life. And this is a way of practicing that hospitality.
Yeah. And I know that you'll agree with me when you have that grieving period where you're not getting to see that sort of physical manifestation of what you and your husband would, you know, who you would make together. But you realize that biology is such a small part of that, because our kids are Kirks and Sneeds. I mean, they are who we have made them together, you know? Like, I mean, we joke sometimes that Orlando is, our eldest is more of a Sneed than we are. I mean, he just, you know, your little, you know, funny little colloquialisms and things that are this, you know, your little, you know, familial biodome of like weird little sayings and inside jokes. And I mean, Orlando just is all of that. And I know that I see that in your kids too. And the just the expressions on their faces, and they don't think of themselves any other way. I mean, it's just
And I exactly. And I think the church speaks really beautifully, Pope John Paul speaks really beautifully about but I think this goes back beyond before him, that, you know, whenever they talk about procreation, the church always speaks both about, you know, the generation of children, but also the education. So, you know, as adoptive parents, obviously we don't get to experience, you know, having the pregnancy and birth, but we do, you know, we do experience the gift of parenthood in all of those other ways. And not just the gift, but the obligations, right? The profound duties that are involved in being a parent. And the church speaks about that as part of what parenthood is both the birth and education of children.
Well, we certainly both have a lot to be thankful for all the time. And this year, is there anything especially adoption related that you are thankful for this Thanksgiving?
Yeah, you know, I say this a lot, and it sounds, I don't know how it sounds, but it's very true. I am so grateful for the gift of infertility, for this cross that we experienced in our marriage, because, you know, as painful as it was and remains, right? Adoption doesn't take that away. It was the occasion for so much fruit. I mean, we know this from scripture that God prunes us in order to make us flourish. And it has been the occasion for our marriage to be stronger and more, you know, giving. And it also was the occasion for these four children, you know, and it whom I believe were meant to be in our family. And
Absolutely.
So I'm really grateful for my crosses for, you know, for the fruit that they born.
Yeah. Well, I think that sounds wonderful. And I feel the same way. So I'm glad that you said it. You know, if you want to find more information.
I'm sure we've shared that view before.
I'm sure we have many, many times. Time's over. Well, if you want to find out more about Elizabeth Kirk, you can find her on the websites of the Columbus School of Law and the Center for Law and the Human Person. And hopefully maybe we'll provide some helpful links to some beautiful things that she's written. And if you want to know more about the Catholic Association, visit catholicassociation.org to learn more about us. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you, Elizabeth, for joining us today. And I hope that you and your family have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
And now Father Roger Landry offers us a thought-provoking homily to prepare us for this Sunday's gospel.
This is Father Roger Landry, and it's a privilege for me to be with you as we enter into the consequential conversation the risen Lord Jesus wants to have with each of us this Sunday, which he gives us the orientations he would like us to have as we begin the season of Advent in a new liturgical year. We've just finished our national celebration of Thanksgiving, which we've had a chance to thank God for all of the ways with which he blesses us year in, year out. One of the sources of gratitude we should have is for the way he constantly gives us new beginnings so that we can improve on what we've gotten right and learn from our mistakes in order to become more like him and take greater advantage of the gift of time we have to grow to love him and others more. Advent is the time in which we go back to the beginnings to get a fresh spiritual start. During Advent, we prepare for Christ's second coming by reliving the preparation of the Jewish people for his first coming, by learning better how to embrace him in the present in the various ways he comes to us, most especially in prayer, the sacraments, and the people he sends us each day. Jesus begins this Sunday's passage by talking about the end times, which he says will feature changes in the sun, moon, and stars, the shaking of the heavens and the roaring of the seas and the waves. He was describing how the things by which people at his time would get their bearings, like the sun during the day and the moon and the stars at night, would be dramatically altered, and people would be like mariners on convulsing seas with thick cloud cover by which they won't be able to get their bearings. Things in which people formerly took their security would be no more. At that time, he said, we would see the Son of Man, Jesus, our incarnate Lord, coming on a cloud with power and great glory. We celebrated, as you remember, last week, the Solemnity of Christ the King, and Jesus here is using a divine image taken from last Sunday's first reading from the book of the prophet Daniel. Jesus was indicating that we would now have to find our bearing exclusively in him, in his divinity shining through our humanity. To this coming, Jesus says we should respond in four ways. First, he says we should stand erect and raise our heads because our redemption is at hand. We shouldn't try to hide. We shouldn't run away. We should lift up our heads, our hearts, our whole existence to our Redeemer. It's common for us to be weighed down by the things of this world, like the woman in St. Luke's Gospel who for 18 years was bent over, incapable of standing up straight, whom Jesus healed on the Sabbath in a synagogue. We often don't take our eyes off the ground. We focus on our worries. We obsess about what weighs us down. As we begin this new liturgical year, Jesus tells us to get up and raise our minds to him, our hearts to him, our souls to him with all our strength. Our redemption is at hand. It's at arm's reach, and he wants us to seize it. He comes precisely to redeem us, and that should make us eager, not alarmed. Second, Jesus tells us to be vigilant. Elsewhere in the gospel, he gave us a parable about a second coming, which he contrasted the faithful and prudent steward who awaited his master's return and faithfully fed others and himself with the nourishment the master provided, with the unfaithful and stupid servant who said, "My master is long delayed," and began to get smashed and to neglect and abuse the servants under his care. When Jesus came into the world the first time, we recall that some people were vigilant, prayerful, and ready, but most weren't. Mary Immaculate was ready and said a hearty yes to God's will. St. Joseph was ready and therefore capable of adapting quickly to God's mysterious plans. The shepherds were ready, vigilant at night, and ran to Bethlehem as soon as they heard the good news of great joy. The Magi were ready, so alert, in fact, that they were able to discern the newborn king's presence through the presence of a star. On the other hand, Herod was not ready, too caught up in his own pride and sensuality, in his own fears and anxiety, to recognize the source of his authority. The innkeepers weren't ready, too ensconced in their business and in their need for water, that they didn't have room to house their creator. The scholars of the law weren't ready to make even the short 6-mile journey downhill from Jerusalem to Bethlehem to discover and learn from the divine legislator. The vast majority of the Jewish people who had been awaiting the coming of the Messiah for centuries were simply and sadly not prepared when at last he came. Jesus does not want us to be caught off guard like them. He wants us to learn from their mistakes. He wants us to be primed for every way he comes to us, to recognize his presence, to feed ourselves and others faithfully with the gifts he provides. He wants this new church year we begin this Sunday to be the best spiritual year of our life. Third, he tells us to pray, and specifically to pray that we have the strength to escape the imminent tribulations and to stand before him. He's quite realistic about temptations and our need for strength in the face of them. We remember what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus took Peter, James, and John apart from the others to pray with him. He instructed them, "Watch and pray that you may not undergo the test, for the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Their weak flesh, however, won out. They didn't stay awake and pray, but fell asleep. And when the soldiers came for Jesus, they all failed the test. To remain strong under trial, we must remain with God. We must abide with him in prayer. Prayer wakes us up to see that God is alive and with us. It helps us to escape caving into tribulations, but to convert them into opportunities to give witness and glorify God. Lastly, Jesus tells us to make sure that our hearts do not become drowsy from carousing and drunkenness and the anxieties of daily life. This is the opposite of standing erect and raising our heads. This is contrary to vigilance and prayer. The way Jesus does not want us to live is to let our hearts fall asleep by seeking worldly pleasure, or being eaten alive by worries, or by anesthetizing our existence through drunkenness or other addictive escapes. This obsession about pleasure and about escaping pain keeps us from concentrating on Jesus. We can't lift up our hearts to the Lord if our heart is asleep. So as we begin this new liturgical year, it's a time for us to make some resolutions based on Jesus' imperatives, to raise our heads and hearts to God, to remain vigilant, to pray, and to be sober. G.K. Chesterton once said, "The object of a new year is not that we should have a new year. It's that we should have a new soul and a new nose, new feet, a new backbone, new ears, and new eyes. Unless a particular man has made New Year's resolutions," he said, "he would make no resolutions." If we don't make resolutions now, we may never make them. It's a time for us to make concrete plans, to pray more and better each day. It's an occasion to make the choice to come to daily Mass, seeking to meet with eagerness the same Jesus in the Eucharist we hope to meet when he comes in the clouds. It's an opportunity for us to make straight the paths of the Lord through not just a good confession, but the best confession of our life. It's another chance for us to become good Samaritans, to care for those in need, to sacrifice lovingly for our neighbor in imitation of the way Jesus lovingly sacrificed for us. It's the moment to stand erect, raise our heads, defibrillate our hearts, stay alert, and enter into communion with Jesus. One means by which Catholics in various places throughout the centuries have sought to turn this Advent summons into devotion is through the use of the Advent wreath, which we'll bless in our churches and many of us will use in our homes. The most important part of the Advent wreath, we know, is not the color of the candles, which symbolize the hopeful spirit of the weeks, or the evergreens, which symbolize God's eternal life. The most important part of the Advent wreath is the flame, which symbolizes our prayerful vigilance for Jesus' coming. Just like the 5 wise bridesmaids in Jesus' parable, whose lamps were always burning in anticipation for the bridegroom's return, so the flame of these candles symbolizes and reminds us of the flame of desire we're called to have for Jesus' return. The Advent wreath with its light is meant to help us always to remain ready for Christ's light to irradiate our entire life. It's a sign of vigilance, of not falling asleep, of not letting our faith in his love and our longing for him taper off. It's an external sign of how week by week, not just throughout Advent, but through our life and our year, our flame of love for God is supposed to be growing until our entire existence becomes a living flame of love burning for the coming of Christ. Advent is ultimately a gift of the Lord to bring us back to what's most important in life, God's love for us and our response to him in faith and love. Filled with gratitude after having marked Thanksgiving, as we prepare for this first day of the new liturgical year, Let us ask the Lord for the grace to make this upcoming liturgical year a truly holy one, a year of prayer, a year of faith, a year of increased love, a true year of the Lord. O come, Emmanuel. God bless you.
Thank you, Father Roger Landry. Make sure to catch all of his great work at catholicpreaching.com, or you can follow his writings at the National Catholic Register. Go to ncregister.com. And until next time, we wish you all the very best, and you go with our prayers.